second tune there from the Hot Rock Pilgrims and Mean Mother Blues. Before that, Bear Hunter, What Are We Fighting For? A bit of an unusual band for Fire in the Mountain, that, because they were loud and their guitars, it was great. Before that, Mobius Loop and Living in the Milky Way. Well, if all's gone according to plan, I should be joined now on the line by not one, not two, but three members of the Dark Mountain team. Are you all there, folks?
Yes.
Hey, that sounds really grand. I think we've got you all. You're all showing on the meters, so I guess they can probably hear you out there. It's great to have you on the show after your fantastic performance at Fire in the Mountain. Perhaps you'd like to take it in turns to give us a bit of an intro to each of yourselves and tell us how you got involved with the Dark Mountain Press, and perhaps remind people of what it is you do.
That's lovely, Ben. Who wants to kick off?
Why don't you kick off, Dougie?
Yeah, go for it, Dougie.
Okay. So, hi, my name's Dougie Strang, and I got involved with Dark Mountain not long after the manifesto came out, which was just a very brief recap. That was a manifesto written by two writers, Dougald Hind and Paul Kingsnorth, and that was written in 2009. And they were a couple of journalist writers who had become somewhat disillusioned with mainstream environmentalism. Not so much that they thought that people were doing bad things, but that just that they'd maybe lost sight of some of the deeper meanings behind the environmental movement that had kicked off. And they set up this manifesto really as a challenge to say, well, wait a minute, what is going on here? With the best will in the world, with all this great work that various organizations are doing, still we're facing this unprecedented ecocide, we're facing climate change, and how are we responding to this? That was the kind of challenge, you know, and in particular, what are the artists doing? What are the writers doing? The musicians? Where's the cultural response to this situation that we find ourselves in? And that kicked off quite a kind of wide discussion between sort of mainstream environmentalists and people on the fringes. And there was quite a lot of controversy in a way that that manifesto caused. And in the way of manifestos, it was kind of a planting of a flag, and it was deliberately challenging. But I think it also was carrying a deeper truth, which is that we do find ourselves in these really unprecedented times, and where's the kind of deep story that's underpinning a lot of what's happening? And I think that's what really picked my interest. And I won't say too much about my own story, but I guess I was at the time, so this is back in 2009, 2010, I was living in a self-sufficient community in southwest Scotland with my family. We were living kind of as close to the land as we could. We'd built our own little straw bale house. We were growing most of our own food. We were really kind of living that frugal, back-to-the-earth lifestyle. And I was finding a great deal of joy in that. But at the same time, I was also beginning to educate myself. I was reading a lot of books about climate change, about ecocide. So that tension between living really well on the land, but also seeing and beginning to learn of this wider story that was going on in the world. And it was depressing, because you read the books and there's no happy chapter at the end. You know, it's like this is happening. It is getting worse. What do you do? So I was looking for a way to come to terms with a lot of that. And I heard about the Dark Mountain Project, went along to the first gathering, and it really just, it just ticked a lot of boxes for me. It felt like here was a bunch of people who were willing to have that conversation, willing to be honest about what was going on in the world, and not to then despair. You know,
it's not a popular conversation, is it?
Well, that's right. And you know, people tend to glaze over if you start to, even now, you know, 8 years on, when we know so much more about what is happening, people still tend to not really want to hear about it. So one of the challenges. Go on.
It's interesting that, isn't it? Because you're having no problem attracting a huge variety of contributors.
That's right. I mean, we definitely, I think, we staked out a territory that maybe not that many other people were exploring in that particular way. Mm. And you're right, it's really, it's a flag that a lot of people have gathered around. And I think part of it was saying, we don't have the answers, you know, but what we are going to do is hold this space and invite people to come in and just have this discussion. So there's something quite liberating about that. You know, we're not a top-down didactic organization. We're just saying, okay, let's see if we can talk about this and let's see if we can find ways forward that not, don't necessarily include the big scale solutions, but are about the stories of people's lives and what we can actually realistically do in our lives.
Yeah, oh, it's so, yeah, a really, really great introduction to you and the Dark Mountain Press, I think. Mm-hmm. What about you, Ava?
Well, I was at university when I came across the project, studying environmental science. So I had recently come from living in rural France and moved back to the UK with an idea that I was going to go and learn about the science that everybody was talking about, and I was going to go and do it in an institution that was, you know, at the forefront of the research that was happening. It was at the University of East Anglia that was really like exploring climate change and looking at behavioural change and how we can kind of motivate people to think and act differently. And I went with such great expectations to go and feel like I'd be challenged and have my underlying philosophy of life looked at, and I actually went and found, although a lot of it was really inspiring, I found myself being quite disaffected by academia and the kind of scientific process. And obviously the science is really important behind the process of the way we work out what's happening with the climate and what's happening with the world, but there was something missing. There was like a human element missing, and it seemed a little bit remote and at arm's length. It felt like the research that was going on was, you know, there were still scientists flying halfway across the world to conferences, and it just didn't quite feel very embodied. And actually, the way I first came across the Dark Mountain Project was I met someone on a train, and she had just met a man called Jeppe Graugard, I think is how you say his surname. He's Danish. I always struggle with his surname. But he was doing a PhD, and he was writing his PhD about the Dark Mountain Project. And he was setting up an art exhibition, like an installation, for one night called the Heart Mind Computer. And that was something that he set up kind of as a branch off from his PhD and the research he was doing about the crossovers between art and science. And he was within the environmental science school at the university. So I actually ended up being one of the artists as part of this pop-up thing, and started hanging out with Jeppe quite a lot. And through Jeppe, we started having these meetings called the Dark Marshes meetings with a few other people who are still involved with the projects now. And we kind of just gathered on a regular basis at different people's houses and had a very personal conversation about the way that these issues were affecting our lives, what we were thinking about it at the time. And for me, it created a kind of family, really. I think especially for a lot of students, you end up hanging out with people who are exclusively your own age, and it's a very kind of segregated world. So for me to hang out with PhD students and older people and younger people, and it was like we were drawn together because we really believed in the same things rather than because we were the same age, and that was great for me. And then eventually I went to I was involved in that for a while, and then I decided to write my dissertation my final year about the project, and I went to the Uncivilization Festival. I think it was the second to last one, the third one that happened. And I interviewed 12 of the core members, including Dugald and Paul. I think I didn't interview you, Doogie. Did I interview you, Doogie? I don't know. I can't remember. But I definitely interviewed him. And I interviewed a few key people and then wrote my project about that. And since then, been involved as much as possible. I'm now the editorial assistant, which means I help whichever combination of editors are working on the books. And I receive a lot of the submissions and work with doing some admin stuff. And I also help to organise some of the events that we do, including Basecamp at Embercombe last September, and more recently the book launches I'm taking on, trying to make sure that we have a launch for every book that we release.
Yeah.
And that's my favourite work, really, working on the events, having people come together and talk about these things in person.
That's become quite an important part of the project, hasn't it? How did that come about, that you ended up doing literary festivals as well as printing books?
Well, I think it was a necessity, really.
And an accident.
And an accident, yeah. You talked to Paul at Dougald about it. They said they kind of started off with this kind of quite vague idea, and then suddenly they were running a festival. And I think it became a bit much. That's why the Uncivilization Festival stopped happening, because actually they wanted to focus on the books. But it seemed as soon as it happened, that as soon as the festivals happened, that it actually was really crucial that people weren't just being remote. You know, this wasn't just happening in people's own homes and they were connecting. It was actually, as soon as people were brought together, I think that was a really, I don't know, it seemed like quite an important thing.
It's a huge variety of stuff you cover, isn't it? Because the climate change thing, of course, always causes a fair bit of difficulty. But it's not just that, is it? It's the general ecocidal tendencies of mankind that we're talking about here.
I think that was one of the kind of unseen consequences of the project. Did start as a literary circle, I think was how it was first envisaged, or maybe a kind of, a journal that would reflect the writing that people were doing. And what the festival showed is that the need was far greater than that. There were musicians, artists, thinkers, academics, philosophers, people that don't identify as writers of all different kinds. So I think that's why it kind of mushroomed into an event that nobody had seen coming.
It struck me as unusual what Ava was saying about a man doing a scientific dissertation and trying to bridge the gap to the arts, because of course art and science did used to be two faces of the same coin, didn't they?
Exactly, yeah, and that's what I actually wrote about in my work that I did at uni, was about kind of both of them being a method of inquiry, of exploring the world. And the way that we look at science now is very kind of dogmatic and challenging that, really. Not necessarily challenging it and saying it's bad, but just saying that we need to give art the weight that it carries. Yeah, and I think that that's something that actually I remember Dougal saying to me in the interview that I did with him, which was that art has been the space where things that, he said it so eloquently, I do not claim to be as eloquent as Dougald, but he said art is the space where things that have not been allowed have been able to dwell. All the magic has been able to live in art. And it's often at the forefront of societal change and cultural change. And that for me has been, totally important, totally vitally important to the project. That's what it's about.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that strikes me is that science has developed its own language, its own way of measuring things, putting things across. And our original natural scientists, the guys from the 17th, 18th century, were actually brilliant with words. And, the way they put their science across was actually comprehensible and interesting and was quite often a work of art in itself. Oh, God, we've lost the stream. Hang on.
I hope I really need it.
Hello. Hello. Right, okay, let's just fade that song out. there we go. Sorry about that, folks. For some reason, I lost the stream, but the Skype was still working, apart from some of it, which wasn't. So we've obviously got a bit of a dodgy stream, folks. Sorry about that.
This is how Dark Mountain runs, mainly on disconnected Skype conversations.
We have a lot of it here as well. I think we were talking about how science and art have become dissevered, as it were, and I was trying to suggest when we got cut off that the original natural scientists in the 17th and 18th century actually wrote amazing prose as well as doing good science, and that's sort of ceased to happen, hasn't it?
That's right, yeah. Although it's interesting that
it's interesting that there seems to be a movement to try and resynthesize the two, and this is not just from Dark Mountain calling, but
you know, I've noticed within the sort of wider art world, there's a lot more collaboration going on between scientists and artists. It's happening a lot. And there's projects like Cape Farewell and various ones that are putting artists and scientists together and saying, you guys need to have a conversation because actually what you artists can do, and I say that in the wide sense of the word, artist as in painters, poets, writers, musicians, you know, creative people. It's like what you can do is you can tell stories. And scientists are great with the facts and the figures, but actually it's like how do you take that information and turn it into a story that is digestible by people and that makes sense in their lives. And I think one of the things I quite find quite heartening is that it feels like those collaborations are increasing again. So maybe that's one of the things that's coming out of this time that we find ourselves in, is that specialization, you know, that putting people in their silos and saying, well, you're a scientist, you only deal with that. And you're an artist, you only deal with that. But actually maybe there's a coming back together again, which is heartening, I think.
Yes, I think it is. I mean, I think that all sorts of people are feeling all sorts of changes in the world. Do you think we might actually be making some progress with projects like this in changing people?
We've always been very very careful to shy away from talking about tangible progress, actually. Because what Doogie said, and that's not meaning to sound negative, but what Doogie said earlier about the space for questions, certainly that was what drew me to the project, the space to have uncertainty and to admit that you don't know the consequences of what you're doing, and these things can't be quantified and measured in the way that we've become accustomed to kind of expecting, you know, campaigns to deliver certain policies or certain targets to be reached. I think there is a great creative uncertainty about the Dark Mountain Project that allows people to dwell in a space of not knowing and not having the answers.
I think that's a very interesting point, because it seems to me that people are very certain about what they know, even if they've only seen it in a newspaper where it's not likely to be too true. I think the recognition of uncertainty itself is an interesting point.
Absolutely. I think that the grey areas, it said in the editorial of the latest book, actually, we talk a lot about grey areas. And for me, that was also something that drew me to the project, was this idea of things being, it not being about like a progress. It's not being about setting a target and achieving it and having a finite vision of what you're going to expect. It's actually more about really allowing yourself to not know. And I think what Doogie was just saying about the role of artists and scientists coming together is really important, but you also have to be really careful that you don't let art become a tool for science, because actually it's something completely different. And it's something that works in much more of a magical, less definable, less tangible way that's really actually, you know, vital to all of these things. And it's a much more human way of experiencing things. And if there's too much agenda attached to the art, is like, we need to change people, then it stops being art and starts becoming propaganda. And I think that's something that I've always really enjoyed about the project, is it's not trying to change people, it's just trying to express where we are.
Yeah, I think that's a very good way of putting it. What about you, Nick? What brought you to the project?
I think it was that kind of space of uncertainty. I hadn't come from academia, but I'd come from a background of environmental campaigning. The campaigns organised very much along the lines of, you know, we need to get more people on the streets and one big push, and we're going to convince the politicians to sort the problem out. And also through journalism, so I was writing articles about you know, environmental issues, but at the same time I was writing these quite odd and very unsellable short stories. I wasn't really sure if they were short stories or not. They didn't have a particular purpose or point, but they were expressing things that were kind of going on in the world, I suppose. One of them was about a group of men climbing up a Welsh mountain and clubbing a lake monster to death, and just feeling the need to keep clubbing and to keep hitting the thing. long past the point in which it was dead. So it's quite a brutal, bleak story. And another one that was about a journalist going to a dinner where people are consuming the ghosts of extinct species and extinct human species and extinct plants and languages in a great vat of soup. And I'd kind of sent these to some magazines who didn't ever get back to me. And then somebody suggested that they had some friends that were starting a journal called Dark Mountain, and it sounded like the sort of thing they might be interested in. And it, something about the I think that not the subject matter so much as the tone of the stories, the feel of them, somehow resonated with what Dugald and Paul were trying to express. And when I read the Uncivilization Manifesto, the sort of document that started the whole thing off, I felt exactly the same thing. It felt like somebody had put into words what I'd been feeling and struggling to express for a long time, but I had no idea how to do it. And I think a lot of it was the admission that maybe everything's not going to be okay. Maybe one last push isn't going to be enough. How do we feel about that? And what kind of art do we make? Mm. And the extraordinary thing about that is it's not despairing and it's not full of doom. And actually, I found a kind of hope that I certainly wasn't finding in the mentality of campaigning or the mentality of environmental journalism. That was about being honest and being prepared to admit the worst, but then see what's beyond that.
Yeah.
And so I got more and more drawn into the project from submitting those original stories. I came on board as an editor of the journals. So we work with four editors normally, and we kind of all collaboratively edit the books, often on these ridiculous Skype conversations that never work. Somehow the whole thing comes together. And more recently, I've become involved on the online side of Dark Mountain. So I'm the online editor. I edit the blog and the new website, which is about to be redesigned and relaunched. And really discovered this kind of extraordinary community of people from all different backgrounds, now all different countries. It started off very much a British concern. And now we have submissions from America, Australia, India, couple of African countries, there's like countries in Europe, and it's kind of these little mushrooms popping up as the word kind of filters out, and somehow the message of Dark Mountain does strike a chord with some people, and
yeah,
again, that's quite magical.
I think one of the really important things there is that, you know, whenever somebody uses the little meme climate change, it causes a lot of people to rise up in support of the dogma, and a lot of people to assume that because we're using the phrase, we're talking from a dogmatic place. But one of the things that struck me about the three Dark Mountain books I've got now is that you're actually getting somebody's personal experience of how, because the climate is changing for whatever reason, and what you're getting is people's personal view of it from all over the world. And that way you're kind of breaking out of the sort of straitjacket that we seem to find ourselves in. And it's one of the most striking aspects, I think, of the writings in Dark Mountain, is that broadening of the idea. Rosie Bold actually did some research on what this meant to the people in the Andes, didn't she? And they had a completely different idea from us.
Yeah.
That's right. And again, and I think that raises one of the interesting points, which is we in the West view the unfolding of the world through the prism of kind of Western modernist society. And again, one of the things that I think Dark Mountain is trying to promote is this idea that that's only one narrative. You know, it's become a very central narrative in the West, but it is only one narrative of how the world works. You know, this myth of progress, this myth that, you know, technology will save us, all these things that come out of a kind of industrial society. There are still other people in other parts of the world who don't tell that story. You know, they've got a very different story to say about how this is all unfolding. And we're trying to find those different ways of seeing and being in the world that offer an alternative narrative to the sort of the doctrine of progress, you know, and that's been for me, you know, as somebody who's really interested in storytelling and actually the kind of embodied storytelling, it's just wonderful to see that actually it is just a story, this idea that we all have to live in this kind of modernist society, and that there are other stories and there will be other stories long after this civilization has gone its way, whatever way it goes, you know, there will be other stories and other ways of being. And I find that really hopeful, you know. Mm-hmm. There is that thing, it's a bit of a kind of cliche in Dark Mind, but this idea of the end of the world is not the end of the world, full stop, you know, it's just the end of one way of being in the world, this particular model that we seem to be locked into.
And there is a feeling that it is stepping off the edge of the cliff, that it is a dying thing. And I suppose one of the things we're talking about is working on where we might go next, what we might explore further.
That's right. That's right. And Martin Shaw, who's a wonderful storyteller, who's been very, you know, he's written and performed at a lot of our events, and he talks about this idea of, well, if this is a time of things coming to an end, then at the very least we owe it to the world to do that with a bit of elegance and a bit of panache. And I really like that idea that, you know, we can lament things that have to be lamented, but we can also say, this is the time we find ourselves in. And there's still going to be beauty and joy in that time. And how do we sing those songs as we're going through this undoubtedly bumpy ride?
It's an important thing to remember, isn't it? That whilst this mayhem that we're talking about does seem to be entirely pervasive, that a lot of the time, a lot of people are actually doing things like Doogie, living on a self-sustaining community or whatever, or doing fire in the mountain, that actually on the ground, people are still getting on and they are actually making things work in new ways.
And often people are doing it in quite a quiet way, which is interesting because it suggests that there's all kinds of things going on that are unconnected, but part of the same movement that people don't necessarily know about.
For me, that quietness is quite important as well. You know, I've always felt like the project is somewhere between hope and despair. It's like acknowledging the truth of what's really going on, but it's not kidding yourself that we can change everything. So that quietness, like Nick says, is a lot of the really inspiring, motivating things that are going on aren't the things you hear about, because they're tiny successes, you know, they're small victories.
And when you do get a big one, because the Uncivilization Manifesto made quite a hit with the New York Review of Books, didn't it?
Yeah, it did.
And took quite a kicking as a result. So as soon as it sticks its head above the quiet parapet and attracts the attention, you end up getting called collapsitarians.
It's a blessing and a burden, I think, you know, that attention, you know, it can definitely help to spread the word. You know, we believe in the work that we're creating, so we want to go out to an audience. But yeah, you do also get people who want to paint a very black and white picture. You know, they want to say, you know, they want to pin you down. And one of the joys of this project is that, partly because of the breadth of people involved, but also I think there's that tricksterish nature to it, which is we don't want to be pinned down. You know, we're actually going to be quite undefinable. And that feels necessary, I think, in many ways.
You attracted a lot of very enthusiastic and quite young people at the Fire in the Mountain Forum. I guess you get to see all ranges, don't you?
Well, one of the things I was going to say is that, and this is partly reflecting on Fire in the Mountain. I mean, you know, Britain has had this festival culture since the 60s and 70s, but again, what I see is that story of that need to come together, the idea of carnival, the idea of sort of celebrating, it does feel like it's no surprise that at a kind of tough time, there's this flourishing of all these different events, because it's back to that thing of what do we need, you know, what feeds us. And one of the things that feeds us is coming together to hear music, to dance, to sing, but also to discuss. So the forum at Fire in the Mountain is that chance to say, well, I've had an earful of music last night, but now I want to actually hear what other people have got to say and have a conversation. And you're right, it's great the breadth of people that get interested. Not because we have some great wisdom to impart, but rather because we just want to be there, open, saying, well, you know, here's our experience. This is what our experience is grounded in. What do you think about that? What's your experience grounded in? How does it feel on the ground to be living in this time? And I think, again, it's back to stories. We're interested in stories, what people's stories are. I think it's really important.
Yeah, yeah. And you chose I thought the idea of producing a literary journal was a pretty unique and inventive response to this situation in itself. And the fact that you're turning out probably the most beautiful books I've seen for a long time. It's important, the quality of the book itself, isn't it?
Yeah, it was always meant to be a thing that lasted. So they're not all hardback, but they started out as pretty solid hardback books. We're now experimenting every other issue with form. So that might be a paperback or it might be something else entirely. But definitely the quality of the object is very important.
So how has it developed from what did you start doing and where have you got to? What was the process you went through? Because I can see they are changing.
Well, it started out as quite a straight anthology of things that people submitted, from academic essays to kind of creative nonfiction, to short stories, to poetry, to artwork. And I think certainly the first one, it was people responding to this call very strongly. But they've become more shaped, I think, over the eight or so years we've been doing it. And about three years ago, we decided we suddenly got double the number of submissions that we'd had before. It was kind of word had spread, and suddenly we just got inundated. So we had enough for two books, so we decided to make two books and kind of double our production to two books a year. And then out of that, we started doing these themed issues. So the first one of these was Dark Mountain issue 8, which was called Techne. And for the first time, we kind of we decided it was going to be nonfiction, so it was essays, and it was going to be artwork. No poems, no short stories. And it was about our relationship with technology and with technological thinking and how to live with technology and what technology is doing to our society or what our society is doing to technology. So it's this real kind of philosophical exploration of what technology is. And then to counterbalance that, two issues later for Dark Mountain 10, we did Dark Mountain Uncivilized Poetics, which was not just an anthology of poetry, but it was essays and writing about the poetic language, poetic imagination, poetic consciousness, which is really a kind of, the other end of the balance to the rationality and logic of techne. We wanted to have the creative energy and the poetic. And the next book, Dark Mountain 13, which is coming out later this year, is very different again, and is loosely based on the spiritual or spirituality, though I think it's not going to be maybe named as spirituality as such.
Yeah, I'm going to have to subscribe, really, because I'm, as you know, I got the Uncivilized Poetics from you at the festival, and got Techne, you posted it to me very kindly, Nick, and I'm reading them at the same time, so I'm kind of bouncing between one and the other, and I can really feel the contrast that you're setting up. And I think the quality of the anthology and the concentration of ideas is of a oneness, if you like, with the quality of the books themselves. I think it's a very clever thing you're doing.
That craft of bookmaking is also very important. And a lot of people, there was a conversation about, well, should we be making these books available on tablet, or, you know, can you download them in a readable form? And we just thought, well, actually, no, we believe in books. We believe in the object and the beauty of the object. So that sense of a crafted object feels very, very important to us. And you're right, that aesthetic matters, I think. And that's as much to do with the idea that I think many of us involved with the project have, which is that rather than just criticizing contemporary culture, you actually say, well, okay, here's our offering. You know, it's easy to criticize the shallowness of the kind of throwaway culture that we have, but instead of criticizing it, we'll put an offering of something that we hope will still be around for a while, these beautiful books. So it is important.
I think that making energetic progress in the other direction is always a good idea.
Yeah, that's right.
Sorry, go on, Ava.
I like the idea of what you said of reading issues 8 and 10 together. That's a really nice way of doing it with the poetics and the techné. It's like that's like creating your own amalgamation, your own combination of the art and science that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah,
it's a bit like I gather that your rods and cones in your eyes arrange themselves in a completely different way when you look at red and when you look at blue. And reading these two books at the same time, and it's ideal for me because I'm really busy at the moment. And of course, you've got nice short pieces, so you can actually focus on one and really enjoy it, sit and think about it for a bit, and then flip over to the other side, as it were. And it is kind of an expression of a unification of science and poetry, those two particular editions. It's very exciting kind of read.
Yeah, that's great.
That's a good way of doing it.
So, I think the poetry thing is becoming more important to me. One of the first things I noticed in the first one I got, which is around here somewhere, I can't remember which one it is. It's the one with the picture of the log on it with all the trees around the outside. And I'm an English graduate, so I've actually got a degree in English, but I haven't read any poetry for a couple of decades, and there was so much impressive poetry in that first book that I've started reading it again. And the same is true of The Uncivilized Poetics. There's some brilliant stuff in there, one of which I'd like to read before we finish.
Oh, please do.
Well, I mean, perhaps I could do it now, because a bit of discussion of poetry is, I think, a good way to go, because I know we were joined in the Fire in the Mountain Forum by Sam Robinson, who did his talk, Can Poetry Save the World? And I know that he's familiar with your work as well. And actually, he was the first person, again, for years, that I've actually talked about reading poetry and about what it is and what it does and how it does it. So perhaps I could read this little one here, and then we could have a quick chat about poetry, why it's important, and perhaps why it appears to have disappeared entirely from, you know, say, mainstream newspapers. You don't get a poetry page, do you?
That's right.
So this one's called A Ritual to Read to Each Other by William Stafford, and I think is a particularly powerful piece of work amongst many powerful pieces. And it says, if you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, a pattern that others made may prevail in the world, and following the wrong God home, we may miss our star. For there is many a small betrayal in the mind, a shrug that lets the fragile sequence break, sending with shouts the horrible errors of childhood storming out to play through the broken dike. And as elephants parade, holding each elephant's tail. But if one wanders, the circus won't find the park. If one wanders, the circus won't find the park. I call it cruel, and maybe the root of all cruelty, to know what occurs, but not recognize the fact. And so I appeal to a voice, to something shadowy, a remote, important region in all who talk. Though we could fool each other, we should consider, lest the parade of our mutual life get lost in the dark. For it is important that awake people be awake, or a breaking line may discourage them back to sleep. The signals we give, yes or no or maybe, should be clear. The darkness around us is deep. Mm. Really great.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Mm.
So that line, it's important that awake people be awake.
I love that. You've got that actually on the cover, and it's worth a bit of discussion itself, that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems to me like a responsibility.
Well, one of the things is, isn't it, when, I mean, what it brought to my mind is that, or just as an example, it should be obvious to everybody, because they're being fined tens of millions of pounds every year for ethical drift and stuffing people with junk bonds and stuff, that the banks are criminal. But everybody's behaving as if they're not. So they're kind of awake to the facts, but not awake enough to do anything about it.
Yeah, I think that's really that. I think that goes to the core of a lot of this stuff, that we assumed for a long time that if people were simply educated about what's going on, that would produce the change. And that was the great kind of fooling of the internet. Everyone thought, oh, the internet's here. Everyone can know everything. Nothing can be hidden. Surely that's going to shift everything. And it's the same with climate change. You kind of, you know, I spent years thinking, oh, well, if only the general public knew this statistic or knew this fact or knew the percentage of ice that's falling off this ice shelf or that, you know, that would be the shift into a different consciousness. And it hasn't happened. And it's not enough just to know something intellectually, partly because there's so much conflicting information, but also you need to feel it. You need to embody it. And that's why poetry is so important, because that can shift us into different ways of thinking in a way that reading, you know, 100 academic essays or kind of looking at sheets of statistics can't do.
Mm. Also, I think you know, you can have really complicated debates summed up by everybody using the same phrase, like climate change, whereas your poet is specifically trying to find other ways of getting across a familiar message in an unfamiliar way.
Yeah,
absolutely. There's a really good example of that I was reading recently about, this is slightly off topic, but it's somewhat related, but you know, when we talk about the very start of everything, the start of the universe, we talk about the Big Bang. And I was reading in a book recently where I think it was Thomas Berry, who was this American kind of eco-philosopher, and he was talking about how what a kind of base term for the beginning of everything we know of, and it wouldn't be better to call it something like the Great Flaring Forth. And I just thought, there you go, that's what poets do. They kind of take the kind of base material and they turn it into something far more rich and suggestive and magical. And it is about that, I think. I much prefer the idea that everything began with a great flaring forth than a big bang. You know, it just feels like I'd rather be part of the great flaring forth, I think, than the big bang. So I think that is what poets can do. I think that's what poets and artists can do. And the one other thing I would say is that I don't know if any of you caught any of the clips of Kate Tempest at Glastonbury.
I was there. I was in the crowd.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, well, maybe you can speak to that, Ava, but, you know, she's a poet who I think is expressing some of our society's indignation at the bankers and the politicians. And she's doing it so powerfully.
What's the lady's name again?
It's Kate Tempest. Yeah. How was it, Ava? How was that?
Amazing. I've seen her perform that album a few times, and I caught the end of the set at Glastonbury because I've seen it recently, but it moves me every time, and I can see that it moves her every time that she performs it as well. It's really real, you know, she feels it, and it's amazing that it's become so mainstream. I've been following her for quite a few years, And for me, honestly, like, poetry is something that I've tried to engage with, but I really struggle with. I struggle to engage with poetry in a way that makes me really feel it. I know when I like it, and most of the time I don't. So Kate Tempest was someone for me that just absolutely, consistently, everything she's done, I've been completely inspired by. I consider her a bit more of a prophet, really, in the way that she performs. But again, yeah, I would say that in some of the stuff in the issue, in issue 10 as well, has that kind of, it's something to do with it being, yeah, it's something to do with it being pure. It's like it comes out with a force of intention that isn't muddied somehow. And I think that about the poem that you just read as well. Yeah, it's something to do with authenticity and realness. And I remember Sam talking about that at the forum as well. Something, you know.
I thought he was very moving on the subject.
He was, yeah, incredibly so. He was very eloquent and, inspiring chap.
Well, it's good that we're getting, I guess it's good we're getting poetry that's reaching people on the stage at Glastonbury.
Absolutely, yeah. Ben. And the thing is, to be blunt,
I think we've lost your mic there.
Sounds like Dougie's fallen in a pit.
It does, yeah. Yeah, it sounds like he's eaten his microphone.
He was about to be blunt, so that's what he said. That's the last thing he said. I'm going to be blunt, and then he disappeared.
Well, he's still with us, is he? Let's have a quick look.
Hello?
He's back.
Yeah, hello?
Hello.
Yeah, we can hear you, Dougie. You're a bit quiet.
Okay. Is that any better?
That's made you quieter.
Okay.
That's better.
Okay, great. Well, what was I going to be blunt about? Oh, yeah. I think it is worth saying. I mean, like so much of our culture, it's like a lot of poetry has, you know, it's been hollowed out. You know, you get this very intellectual poetry, and I know some people love that, but to me, it doesn't have what Ava was talking about. It doesn't have that kind of purity or authenticity. It just feels like an intellectual exercise. Now, some people love that, and that's fine, but for me, I think one of the things Dark Mountain was challenging was saying, well, what, we want some more elemental work. We want something that's not losing itself in literary theory. And it's hard to do that. It's hard to speak with a clear voice and not become hackneyed or cliched, but I still believe that it's really important. The other person I would mention is Ben Okri has just written and performed this poem about the Grenfell Tower. Mm. And again, I think it's a really good example of how a poet can become the voice of a lot of that anger and emotion that is flowing around a very raw subject for a lot of people in London. And who is it that finds a way of expressing that? It's our poets, you know, and I'd urge you to listen to his.
How do you spell his surname?
So Ben, he's formerly from Nigeria, I think Ben Okri, and is it just O-K-R-I or is it O-C-H-R-I? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think it's O-K-R-I.
Yeah, he's a novelist and poet, and he's written this lovely, powerful, indignant poem about Grenfell that really, again, I think has touched people in a way.
That's another interesting and groundbreaking move, because I can't think of an occasion in which that's happened in the recent past.
That's right. So maybe we are in the time of the poets again. Who knows?
Mm.
I think for me, the way I like to see it is to see poetry embedded in things as well. You know, that we talk about here, we're talking about poets in quite an isolated way, poetry being in a book or, you know, performed as poetry. But actually, I think that poetry, the beauty of words and the beauty of explaining things in that way can be embedded into our lives in a lot more, you know, and Twitter and things like that is literally, it's killing that. It's killing the poetry in all of us. And for me, the method of communication for that is music and other ways of, you know, other kind of creative outlets. But it can also just be in the conversations you have, the essays you write, the emails you send, It doesn't have to necessarily be a poem that's written on a page.
Some of the prose in the Dark Mountain books is extremely poetic in itself.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think that that book, specifically number 10, is about poetics. You know, it's not about poetry. It's about the act of being poetic rather than rather about poems in themselves, although they're often a really good way of expressing poetic.
I think there's also the point, isn't there, that not only is the structure in newspapers and periodicals boring, but the vocabulary seems to me to be incredibly limited and quite often misapplied as well.
Yeah.
And so anything that's seeking to introduce new ways of saying thing and new words, new vocabulary to people, if you get new words, it kind of broadens your mind to new ideas and new concepts.
Yeah, it does. Sure.
And yeah, language is so powerful for that. The way that we use language is really important. I would say that across the board.
So do you all get a go at the editing and the writing and everything? Or, because it seems that you've got a fair pile of editors.
Yeah.
We do. We have a pool of editors. There's always four per book. Ava has the task of being the sort of front line of she receives all the submissions, reads everything. So she's our filter, really.
Wow, that must be a lot of stuff, Ava.
First filter,
yeah, there's several. But
Ava's I'm actually there. Having a break for this book at the moment. Dougald Hine and Steve Wheeler are editing this book, issue 12, and they're structuring it very differently, which means they've commissioned 12 pieces instead of it being a submissions-based, which is, again, connected with what Nick was saying earlier about us doing the books differently. Every other one, we're doing a themed issue. And so I've got a break for this book, which is welcome. But I love it. It's an incredibly privileged position for me to be in, for me to be receiving the raw submissions from all over the world, from all different kinds of people. And almost all of the emails that we receive are really lovingly written, and not only do they include interesting and diverse work, also the emails often say thank you for the books, and they really you know, this work is really touching people all over the place. And it's really amazing. It's a very privileged position to be able to be on the receiving end of that.
Yeah, it strikes me, because I do editing and proofreading as well, strikes me that everybody I've come across has very different ways of doing it. I mean, what's it like having four editors working together? Does that always go smoothly?
No. No, it doesn't. But I think everybody is... We have a good sense of each other now. And I think that's very... Everyone's become friends, I think, through the process of doing it. And it's an interesting process. It kind of feels like nobody's in control of it, which is kind of wonderful. And the book, each book takes shape in a very, to me, a very mysterious way. It doesn't particularly appear to have been guided by any one person, but it's a product of four people working together and working with dozens and dozens of writers who are often, you know, rewriting the pieces they send. Because we have quite an active editing process,
yeah,
and often pieces change, you know, beyond recognition in the course of finishing them, of kind of making the final draft.
And is it growing? Are you getting selling more books and getting more input as time goes by?
I would say I've been working on the book since issue 8, since Techne, and I would say, I mean, there's just more and more submissions every time. When we have the themed issues, there's slightly less because it's more specific of what we're looking for. But there's just so many people who are interested in getting involved in this. I wouldn't be able to say about the other end, who's receiving it. You'd need to speak to our distribution.
Our distribution department.
Yeah. But
which is Charlotte.
Which is Charlotte and Mark in Suffolk. Mm-hmm. But But yeah, for sure, on the inward end, it's a lot of people really wanting to be involved with the project.
Another thing that strikes me as quite remarkable is the price you managed to do the books at, because £15, I mean, this can be quite hard to get a paperback for £15, let alone something that's beautifully bound and illustrated with fantastic glossy prints and good layout. How on earth do you do that? Or is everybody else just ripping us off?
Well, we don't get paid very much, which is one thing.
Mm.
It's a real labour of love, so we kind of do it on a shoestring.
Yeah.
And I think we've been lucky in the typesetter and the company, the guy that designs our books, Bracket Press, have just been fantastic. And I think like Dark Mountain, they like what we do and they like making the books. So everybody's been very reasonable in what they charge us.
That's amazing. So a bit like Fire in the Mountain, really. It's kind of, it's leaderless. It's a sort of flat hierarchy or a holarchy. And it's mostly being done for the love of it and to make something that people can enjoy. I mean, that in itself is something of a change, I think.
I think it would feel like quite a hypocrisy if we were making money from it. because so much of what we're saying is, in some way, anti-capitalist and anti kind of progress in that way. So for it to be a money-making scheme would kill it, I think. It has to be done for the love. Otherwise, people would feel it instantly, I think.
I think it also, it still feels important. It still feels like the arguments that are being made are, I mean, you asked earlier if it's kind of, you know, are we making progress? Are we doing something? And I sort of, I don't know, I kind of criticised that a bit, but actually the it is filtering in, I think, to the discussion. One of the kind of early reviews we had said we were changing the environmental discourse in Europe and in the rest of the world. And I think when it started, this was, you know, it was before the financial crisis, it was before the crash in 2008. And a lot of the stuff that was said in the first books seemed kind of out there. You know, they seemed radical and dangerous and wacky and doom-filled and collapsitarian, and that's what they were criticized for. And then the rest of the world kind of caught them up and the financial crash happened. And then, you know, everything that's happened in politics since happened, and the environmental crisis didn't change, and, you know, the climate change didn't stop. And I think there's a sense now that we, Dark Mountain, has been a bit ahead of the curve. I mean, we're not prophets at all, but I think there's been a sense that trends in the world have caught up to what was being said in the first books. And so the project does feel important, and that's why we're all still doing it, I think. It still feels like these words need to be said and people are ready to listen.
It does seem to me to be to encourage real communication. I mean, not only between the reader and the individual that's done the writing, but when we meet up and talk about it, it's somehow got more depth, more reality. Like you say, importance is perhaps the word.
Yeah, I think that was something that was really clear on all of the gatherings, you know, at Base Camp last year, and then at the Uncivilized Festival that happened four times. It really did feel like a vital coming together of people, and as soon as people are actually together in one physical space, that there's a lot to be said, and there is a lot of interesting conversations that happen there. And we always say, whenever we're running these events, we always want to make sure there's enough time for just mingling and people just talking to each other. Yeah. And it's very difficult to structure that because there's always so much going on and lots of talks and things. But actually, that's a lot of the time the most interesting thing that comes from these events.
Same thing's true of the events that I go to and the workshops and nearly everything. It's the workshops are kind of vehicle for the meeting of the people.
Exactly, yeah.
Mm. Doogie, you were saying something there.
Yeah, I was just going to say, so I don't have too much to do with the actual publication of the books, and I'm more involved in the creating events and helping organising them. And for me, it is that thing of it's taking that conversation off the page and sitting around a fire with people and actually having a chance to explore it. And it does feel like there's real, you know, there's pretty strong medicine in being able to just sit down with a bunch of people and have an open exploration. And again and again, people come to our events or we get involved with things like Fire in the Mountain and we hold those talks. And it's not even just the actual, you know, the talk in the forum. It's then what ripples out after that. It's the conversations people have after that initial, say, presentation. And you just sense that there's a way of engaging with this that sits between the kind of hard rock and the big blue sky, you know, and it's that place that feels creative and interesting and worth exploring. And it's certainly what keeps me involved.
Yeah. And are you planning on having any more events?
Yeah. I mean, we've got sort of, we did base camp last year and one of the conversations we are having amongst ourselves is how do we best put our energy? You know, and as you'll know from organizing events, it can take its toll, you know, and especially if you're trying to keep the cost down and make it accessible. So you're doing it on a shoestring and you can get burnout, you know, if you're not careful. So we're kind of exploring both doing smaller events that are Dark Mountain related, but also collaborating with other people like Fire in the Mountain. And we've had quite a few successful collaborations and that feels like a good way to create things. And I think again, because most of us involved are also writers or artists or poets, we're quite restless. So we don't necessarily want to just do the same festival year in, year out. You know, we actually, or certainly I relish the opportunity to do something a bit different. You know, so earlier this year we were in Reading and we made an event happen in the middle of Reading. And that was really fantastic because it was suddenly saying, okay, a lot of people come to our events and we go somewhere rural and people get a chance to come away from the city and they sit around fires and they swim in rivers. But actually, what does it feel like to go into the heart of quite a big city and make something a little bit subversive happen? And that was great. And people really loved that. So
I should think you're finding people fairly receptive to that, aren't you, at the moment?
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's just, it, to me, it keeps the project fresh. If we can be open and curious to know different ways to make things happen, that's certainly the excitement for me. So going forward, we're planning a few things for next year actually. So yeah, we'll keep you posted.
Brilliant. Is it necessary to have a subscription to the journal to get informed about these things, or do you have a mailing list?
We do have a mailing list. Yeah, and if people sign up to that, I mean, the best way to access us is just check out our website, you know, just Google Dark Mountain. And from the website, you can, there's quite clear links to the mailing list, which will let you know whenever the books come out. It will let you know whatever events are planned. And you can also subscribe to the books there, which is a lovely thing to do because you get these two fantastic hardback books a year. But yeah, the website's a good starting point.
I feel really tempted to subscribe simply because another thing about these books is that you can go back to them again and again, and each thing reads differently after you've read other stuff in the same book, which I find almost a creative process in itself.
Yeah, it is. They're very rich. They're very rich books. There's a lot of depth in them.
Yeah, I still find myself going back to old volumes and enjoying reading, you know, and it doesn't feel stale. It still feels there's freshness in those voices.
Yeah, I agree entirely with that. We've got a question in the chat box from Mahatma Coate. He's asking whether any of you read UN Agenda 21.
No. will you ask him what it is?
Well, see if Mahat can actually sum it up.
Yeah, I've not heard of it.
It's basically a pretty horrendous document about dumbing down education systems, removing large portions of the population, sort of 80%, I think they have in mind. And it's a really in-your-face statement of what the World Management Team think they've got in store for planet Earth. I think it's actually been superseded. I think they're moving on to Agenda 22 now or whatever. I think it's worth a read because I have read it. It's worth a read just to see how much gall these buggers have got. That they not only think this stuff, but they write it down and present it as polity. It's actually got quite an interesting history because I think it actually is pulled from a single phrase that was written by a Belgian in the 1960s or something. And it's kind of grown and germinated and become this really quite an amazing thing. Yeah, okay. Agenda for the 21st Century is what it stands for. Okay. As I say, I think they've already moved on. It's great that you've not heard of it, though. Well done.
Sounds a bit doomy even for us.
Well, they are actually collapsitarians. That's what they're trying to do.
Sure.
Yeah. In their way.
But yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, there's no doubt we're in a bit of a pickle, but I think there's also, I find myself pulling away from the kind of, you know, there's the whole sort of near-term extinction movement, and there's the kind of deep green resistance that say we need to kind of violently bring down civilization and all these sort of things. And I don't know, I mean, I understand people who are driven to a kind of anger that brings them to the kind of direct action of Earth First and things like that. You know, I wouldn't sort of condemn that kind of response. But I also see that kind of violence just feeds violence, you know, and it doesn't feel like it's far more complicated than that, you know. Blowing up the odd dam or kind of predicting that, oh, we're all gone in 80 years. We don't know. The future is unwritten. And it doesn't feel like those big, simple black and white stories of either, don't worry, we're all going to fix it. We'll all be riding around on jetpacks and everything will be fine. Or, oh, it's going to be Mad Max. It's going to be the road. It's going to be complete apocalypse.
It's a bit like what Nick said earlier in the show, isn't it? When he was talking about the environmental activism and getting lots of people on the streets, these big responses don't work. And one of my favourite phrases that was given to me by a friend of mine is that the biggest gift you have to give the world is your own transformation. Everything else is somebody else's problem.
Yeah.
And our approach to that now is we've kind of tied up with a community enterprise, which has nominally been trying to grow food for the last 10 years or so, but doesn't seem to have had the skills necessary to maintain the infrastructure or grow the food. And me and Synchro, we're finding that growing food for local people is totally rewarding for us and for the people, and we think we've found our simple solution, because whatever happens, if we're still growing food, if we're still able to put out lettuce and tomatoes and whatever for people, then in a way that's really the best thing we can do.
Yeah, my dad always used to tell me when I was a kid that the most radical thing you can do is grow your own food.
Yeah,
it just removes you from a system that
We've started off with herbs and chilies, but I think by next year, as well as the culinary herbs, we're going to be doing strewing herbs and medicinal herbs and quite a broad range of stuff. It's very exciting and it's a beautiful way of spending your day. I spend hardly any time on the internet at the moment. In fact, this is the first time I've really been on for any length of time for over a month.
Right.
And I think, Ben, didn't you say that you your ultimate aim was to undercut the local branch of Tesco?
Yeah, and it's amazing. All of our local cafes are getting their salads from Tesco's. Well, they're not anymore. So we're getting salad at a penny a gram. There's sort of 14, 15 different leaves in each bag. So we're undercutting, I think, even Aldi's, but our salad will last in your fridge for 2 weeks.
Absolutely.
Great.
So we are in a small way undermining Tesco's and Aldi's, which I think is great.
I think another illustration of that, and I think, I mean, there's so many strands to this conversation, but one of the events we ran a couple of years back, I remember getting into this conversation with somebody who was talking about their friend, and she was very involved in the environmental movement, and she'd done some great things, and she was very passionately talking about this friend of hers who was from London, and he was about to fly out to do some work, and he was making a film about I can't remember, it was a particular big cat. I don't know whether it was a cheetah or somewhere in Africa. And, you know, he was flying out to do this really important work to kind of try and help the preservation of this creature. And this was all great. And I mean, and you know, on the one hand, of course, that work needs to be done. But it wasn't me, but someone else in the conversation said, well, you know, this guy's from London. Do you know that the sparrow population in London has dropped by, you know, 80% in a decade?
Yeah.
And it was just that kind of, again, that contrast between we like the big sexy picture of, yeah, let's go and save this or let's go and do that. But actually, look around. What's happening on your doorstep? What can you do? Can you dig where you stand? And again, I think it's about having a bit of humility in terms of who we are, where we are as a society, as a culture. What can we actually influence? And I don't know. I guess you need it all. You need both. You need the kind of big United Nations level attempts to try and, you know, moderate some of the worst aspects of climate change. But at the same time, we also need the local. And you know, undercutting Tesco's and, you know, pushing them out of the market is a very fine way to go, I think.
I think that ultimately, we've talked about this in other shows, I think ultimately our best work is going to be done where we are known best. And we are where we are because that's where our work is. That's how I feel.
Yeah.
See, Kitchen Gnomics put into the chat box, the planet will win eventually. Just try to stand well with the real power.
Yeah, well, that's you know, that's not a bad way of putting it.
No.
I mean, I think it's also, it's so much of it is not about thinking you can save the world, but it is about thinking what you can preserve of the current world that might otherwise be lost, whether that's, you know, a local species, whether that's a way of thinking, whether that's a language, whether that's a story.
It could be a local open space, couldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it seems at the very least we're heading for a bottleneck. And what can we take with us that's of value? What can we take through to the other side?
To acknowledge that not everything we have is of value. So to let go of some things is probably okay as well.
I think that letting go is another of the major things that we need to learn how to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we've become so burdened with stuff and taught that we need this stuff and this stuff is essential. But I think absolutely right. I think we need to learn how to get rid of it and how to move away from it.
And do you think we need to learn as well that we don't need to know where we're going in order to take a step towards wherever it is we're heading? And that first step can make huge difference to yourself and to the people around you, whatever it is.
Yeah, I think so. I think people are, you know, there's a great fear of uncertainty and there's a great fear of the blank space on the map. But you're right, just taking a step into that, if it feels right and it feels, you don't know where it's going to lead, but it feels necessary, that's an important thing to do.
I would say something about the project is that although we have a manifesto, we don't really have an agenda. And that's always been really important to me, that it's not like we've got things that we're trying to achieve or somewhere we're trying to go. It's actually every step is a step into unknown and dwelling in the grey areas. And that's why it's inspiring, I think, to a lot of people.
Dwelling in the grey areas. I like that. Well, they were some really nice summings up there. We're kind of coming to the end of the show and I've got a bit of stuff I need to punt before 11. So have you got any sort of closing gems you'd like to pass on? I think you've already done them, actually.
Well, we'd like to say that we are always looking for people to get involved, whether that is sending us writing, whether that's sending us music, whether that's coming to one of our events, or just starting a conversation. So please do check us out, darkmountain.net. God, I don't even know the website.
Yes, it is. It's darkmountain.net.
It exactly. .net.
Dark-mountain.net.
That's right.
Yeah. Also, that we are crowdfunding at the moment for our new website. And that's going to be something that's going to be a lot more inclusive. It's going to be, you're going to be able to access a lot of the stuff that we've done in the past, but also going to try and create a space where people can connect with each other. And Dougald has actually just made a video that's available on the website and on Facebook. We've got a Facebook page as well. And so, yeah, anybody that would like to watch the video, learn about what we're going to be doing and contribute if they're able to, would be most welcome.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much to all of you for coming on and talking to me. I do appreciate that. I've enjoyed that conversation, as I always do, meeting you people.
Yeah, us too. Thank you.
We've enjoyed it too. Thank you for having us on once more.
And for hosting us at Fire at the Mountain as well. It was a really amazing weekend.
No, no problem. I really hope you'd like to come back next year, because I really like having you there, and you're kind of not a fixture, but a bit of a backbone of the thing. And having Sam there as well was just really great.
Oh, we'd love to come back.
Yeah, definitely.
That's good. Well, you've got a couple of slots, and next year we are going to try the open mic performance thing in the evening, but I'd like to organise it a bit so that we get together and we can put something on and see if other people come and join in.
Sounds good.
Sounds great.
Brilliant. I know you've got a good performance base to you, as well as writing excellent books. And I'd back them up. Have a look at thedarkmountain.net. The blog is excellent, and the books are really lovely. £15, very well spent, I think. So,
thanks a lot, Ben.
No problem. Thanks to all of you. I shall. Unfortunately, I won't be able to say goodbye to you once I start playing some music, because we seem to have a bit of a glitch with the system. So I'll say goodbye to you now.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night. And I'll keep in touch with you, Nick, and the rest. And having said goodbye to you, I'm now going to play the John Preston Tribute Band and a track called I Resign from an album called Reduced to Clear, all of which seems vaguely applicable. So thanks for being there, folks. Here's some music for you out there. I'll be back with you in a few minutes, and I'll speak with the Dark Mountain via the Skype and the email. Thanks, folks. You're doing a grand job.